This is Eagle Crag Lake in the northwest portion of the Adirondack Park. Although surrounded by low hills, kayakers can still see the fire tower peeking out on top of nearby Mount Arab. On a sunny, clear fall day like this one, the lake is enveloped in color, a blaze of orange, brown, and bright red leaves, a blue sky reflected in the calm, clear waters. It's just about picture perfect. Except that some of the more than 2,000 lakes in the region are so acidic that fish cannot reproduce in them, and other plants and animals are drastically altered. The Adirondack Park contains almost 6 million acres. The largest park east of the Mississippi, it's bigger than Yellowstone, Yosemite, and the Grand Canyon combined. About half of the park has been protected for more than 100 years by the state as forever wildland. And this lack of development makes it a perfect laboratory for people like John Stoddard, who studies acid rain for the EPA.
My father-in-law was a philosophy professor, and one of his very favorite statements that comes from every scientist he's ever met was, "It turned out to be more complicated than we first thought." And it is.
Stoddard's been studying the problem for more than 20 years, and he says the more researchers understand about acid rain, the less they seem to know. That's because the story of acid rain is a complex one. But here's what they know about how the problem started. After World War II, the nation's economy soared. The Midwest portion of the country was already a manufacturing center. When GIs began returning home and buying things, that role grew even stronger, with cars in Detroit and steel throughout the Ohio River Valley and around Lake Erie. All helped to fuel the country's desire for manufactured goods. But that industrialization came with a high cost. Local pollution was severe in some areas. And to generate power and fuel blast furnaces, local coal was burned. Coal high in sulfur. And that created additional problems.
High sulfur coal largely comes from that area of western Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia. And, yeah, the higher the sulfur in the coal, the more that burning it for power is going to produce sulfur dioxide, which eventually comes down in rain as sulfuric acid.
So did the nitrogen oxide created from so-called mobile sources, the cars and trucks. The increasingly affluent population was driving more and more miles. That nitrogen oxide formed nitric acid as it came down from the skies. Together, these acids devastated lakes in the Adirondacks and beyond.
Because of its geologic history, there's a whole lot of very sensitive lakes there, and maybe as many as half of them were at risk from acid rain during the times when acid rain was at its highest, right about 1970 or the early 1970s.
It took a long time for the lakes to become damaged. That's because natural systems have some capacity to buffer or combat insults such as acid rain. It's not an analogy he likes, but Stoddard says lake buffering is very much like using a household medication for an upset stomach.
If you have too much acid, you take something like a calcium carbonate, which is largely what's in Tums or Rolaids or all of these things, and it buffers the acid. Lakes naturally have some of that stuff in them, calcium and magnesium in particular. The more they have, the more of this acid rain insult they can put up with. Those lakes that started off with only a little bit basically may have gone for 40 years without becoming really acid just because what was being used up was this buffering capacity. And then it's very much a threshold, sort of a light switch effect.
In other words, when the buffering capacity was used up, the switch was thrown and the lakes became acidic. That alone would be bad enough. But acidity isn't the only thing hurting the lakes. Acid rain also mobilizes aluminum. What that means is that it takes a solid form of aluminum found in rocks throughout the region and leaches it out of those rocks and into nearby waterways.
It's in the rocks. It's sitting in the rocks all the time. And when it gets acidified, it becomes mobile.
So now when it rains, our acidic snows melt in the spring, aluminum is flushed into the lakes, and that's a major problem.
It's the most common metal in the rocks of the Adirondacks. It's always been there, but it's only when the pH begins to drop that it gets mobilized and you start to find it in water. It's very toxic to all organisms, but particularly to fish because it accumulates on their gills.
So now you've got a toxic soup.
When the alkalinity reaches zero, the pH drops, the aluminum goes up, and it becomes quite a toxic environment.
Toxic to both the fish and the invertebrates living in the lakes that feed the fish. So that's what happened. And by the 1960s, the acid and the aluminum had combined to wipe out much of the animal life in many Adirondack's lakes.
So what was historically there is now completely gone, and there's a different set of algae living in most of these lakes. There can be a very different set of the invertebrates either living on the bottom of the lake or living in the water, because you've removed the sensitive ones and that allows the less sensitive ones to sort of bloom, if you will. So there's a lot of food web effects that happen because you've completely changed the lower trophic levels, a lot of food web effects that happen besides the fact that it's toxic to the fish. So you could actually, without ever killing fish directly by having too much aluminum, you could actually change the composition of the fish that live in a lake simply because you've changed the food source.
A number of highly publicized environmental disasters in the 1960s led to an increased national environmental awareness by the 1970s. So a number of major regulations were passed at the beginning of that decade, among them the Clean Air Act.
In the first Clean Air Act, which was in 1970, they began requiring power plants to put scrubbers on their smokestacks. Scrubbers are simply a way of taking the sulfur dioxide, which is a gas, out of the emissions before it ever makes it into the atmosphere. And as a result, acid rain, what actually is in the rain, began to go down and has been going down quite consistently since about 1971, 1972.
But that first step was still, as it turns out, not enough.
Even though rates of acid rain were going down, they were still so high that they're still using up the ability of lakes and streams in the Northeast in particular to buffer those acid inputs. It takes a little while. You have to dump acid on a catchment for a little while before you see any effect. And even though the rates were going down, we were still dumping enough on a lot of those catchments that we began to see really serious effects in the 70s and through the 1980s.
And not only were the waterways being downgraded, the forests were hurting as well.
Forest effects are much harder to see because a lot of what happens is more subtle. You don't see, fish go belly up. That's a very obvious effect. Trees don't tend to do that.
What happens is the acid is being buffered by calcium and magnesium in the soils, reducing the availability of those same chemicals for the trees. But calcium and magnesium are critical for the health of some trees. For instance, without calcium, trees such as sugar maples become much more susceptible to insect attacks and freezing weather. It's an indirect effect, but one that's quite deadly.
So the soils are sensitive as well as the lake. As long as acid rain is falling, calcium and magnesium in the soils are going to be leached out. You're going to be removing that native buffering capacity out of the soils.
All this is why studying acid rain is so complex a topic and one of great interest to Stoddard. In 1990, another piece of legislation made a dramatic difference in Adirondack's lake recovery. That year, amendments to the Clean Air Act were passed that called for additional restrictions on sulfur dioxide by as much as 10 million tons.
And the amendments of 1990 have largely done what they set out to do. Rates of acid rain have gone down by about 40 to 50% across the Northeast. And for the first time, starting in the early 1990s, we actually start to see some of the most acidic lakes in the Adirondacks starting to recover. So their pH is going up. their alkalinity is going up.
Until that act was passed, says Stoddard, the lakes had not reached a threshold of recovery. But after the amendments were passed, that changed rapidly.
So even though acid rain had been going down for almost 30 years at that point, or 20 years at that point, it just hadn't reached that threshold level where things started to recover. That, in order to make that happen, it needed a boost, and that was the amendments that were passed in 1990.
The legislation also did one other thing.
The Clean Air Act amendments in 1990 required that EPA do monitoring of ecological effects and report back to Congress on whether all this money was well spent. And the original idea is that if we're going to spend, I think the original estimate was $4 billion a year in order to reduce sulfur dioxide emissions, it would be a really good idea to find out if it's actually doing any good.
So a monitoring network was set up to cover all of the Northeast, as well as the Mid-Atlantic region and some of the Appalachians. Stoddard and other researchers are interested in whether the number of acidic lakes in a place like the Adirondacks has changed since the tighter restrictions went into place. Their benchmark was the mid-80s. At that point, between 15% and 25% of the park's lakes were chronically acidic. That means acidic all the time, year in and year out.
And what we've been able to show by monitoring that population of lakes over time is that that number's probably been cut in half. The amount of change that we've managed to affect with these emissions reductions has been enough to reduce that number by 50%.
And that's important news for Washington.
That's critical information for the regulators in EPA because it tells them the magnitude of the problem. Is this a big enough problem that they ought to be paying attention to it?
So the Clean Air Act amendments appear to have been a major success, at least for those chronically affected lakes, the ones that are acidic all year. However, it's still not clear what the effects are on other lakes in the Adirondacks.
There are also a substantial number, maybe even twice to three times as many lakes in the Adirondacks, for example, that are not acid most of the year. But during the spring, when the snow melts, and the sulfate and the nitrate stored in the snowpack flushes through the lake, they become acidic for a short period, maybe weeks, maybe a month. It's enough, however, to be toxic to fish. It's enough of a pH decline that you actually see aluminum mobilized during that short spring snowmelt period. We call those lakes episodically acidified rather than chronically acidified.
So while the recovery has been strong, it hasn't been as rapid as the researchers had hoped. Even though the Adirondacks is down to perhaps less than 10% of its lakes being chronically acidified,
we might expect with a 50% reduction in deposition, which has happened since 1990, you might expect that number to be down to 5%.
Now, Stoddard and others are asking why. He says there are a broad range of possibilities.
One of them is that the real focus in the Clean Air Act amendments in 1990 was on sulfur and sulfur dioxide emissions that come largely from power plants. It did almost nothing about nitrogen. Nitrogen oxides are another gas that's produced by any combustion process, and when it combines with water in the air, it forms nitric acid. Nitrogen oxides are harder to deal with because you can't simply put a scrubber on a smokestack and remove them.
That's because nitrogen doesn't come from coal. It's a naturally occurring gas that makes up a large portion of the air that we breathe.
There's tons of nitrogen, N2 gas, in the atmosphere. And when you heat it up to a hot temperature, either in an engine or by some natural processes like lightning or volcanoes, it produces nitric acid.
So unlike sulfur, which can be easily controlled, there is no low nitrogen fuel.
Because the nitrogen itself is in the atmosphere. It's the process of combustion that produces nitric acid. So which is a very long-winded way to say that it's technologically a more difficult problem to cope with.
So it's a complicated problem. That's because the primary source of nitrogen oxides in the air is what are called mobile sources. That's cars and trucks.
So one of the intriguing possibilities is that what we're seeing, one of the reasons we're not seeing as much recovery as we are, is because we're simply swapping over time sulfur for nitrogen. Sulfur's going down in a lot of, in some places, nitrogen may be going up. It's not a very clear signal.
Despite all these difficulties, Stoddard says he's hopeful for at least some level of complete recovery.
I'm very hopeful that we'll see chemical recovery, that we'll be able to go back to a pretty pre-industrial chemical composition in lakes and streams.
But he's less hopeful about a complete biological recovery.
We may never see, you know, all of the lakes in the Adirondacks go back to their original fish composition, even though their chemistry has really recovered.
That's because such recovery will require long-gone species to move back into those lakes. And the mechanisms for that to occur, says Stoddard, may be tough to create. So there are a lot of questions left that are still begging for answers. Which brings John Stoddard back to his original point.
We probably know more about acid rain than any other environmental problem in history. And one of the main things we've learned is how little we really know.
So for now, the research continues. For EPA's Science in Action, I'm Donna Vincent Roa.